welcome to Didion Hawthorne in the In-Between, or DHNI. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to our podcast about the relevance of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. Hello, hello, and welcome to the show. Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu unserem Podcast. Today is a very special episode because it is our 3-year anniversary on the air. And I'm going to do something which I am equally dreading and looking forward to, which is listening to our first ever episode and giving commentary on it. Since it is our anniversary, though, I have to thank you guys so much. I would not be doing this without my amazing audience behind me. I find doing this show such a valuable tool for me. It's such a valuable lesson every week for me to curate content for you all. So really, thank you from the bottom of my heart. I'm really grateful for all of you. Now, in terms of my first impressions on all of this, I do remember that my editing was really janky. I remember that I took this really long interview and I just edited a lot. And it took me forever to edit the first couple episodes. There was a huge learning curve. The only editing skills I had at this point were from literally Apple Camp when I was a young kid, and it was a super valuable experience at the camps. Don't worry, don't get me wrong here. I used Mac software when I was very young, and I'm super fortunate to have developed skills on both Mac and Windows, so that was a skill set that I absolutely found myself using when I started the podcast. But aside from those few training sessions with the GarageBand software, which is what I edit on, I really didn't have any prior experience whatsoever. So this first episode was my ultimate guinea pig, but I definitely enjoyed the process enough to keep going for this long. And without further ado, let's get into it. Southern Arizona. We're sitting at a kitchen table centered right alongside a window overlooking the desert in one of those infamous ranch-style houses. This is the desert, but not the commercialized nouveau western desert. It's the real desert in its unbridled, unrelenting glory. As always, tea and cookies are laid out in a pseudo-minimalist fashion. I'm sitting across from Lucine Dieter, a student at nearby Arizona State University, and we're about to discuss White Noise by Don DeLillo. It's at the heart of the postmodern genre. Hello and welcome to Didion Hawthorne and the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. This is not nearly as bad as I was thinking it might be. I love the intro that I just heard. I remember really spending time being intentional with it, writing it over and over again, etc. I remember I worked really hard on it, and this was something that I used to do. I used to say something pithy or read out a couple lines of prose before the intro music to the podcast. Honestly, what started happening about a year and a half in was I just did not have enough ideas, and I was trying to make it funny sometimes, and it just wasn't coming out right. So that was one thing that I did change eventually, and now, of course, we just start with the intro music. But I might experiment with that a little bit again, because I do really like the way that sounds and how it sort of starts off mysterious, and it starts off with a scene, kind of like a novel in some ways. That's really interesting. Also, I really love how I integrated the music with the introduction. I remember that I used to speak out, I used to read out every introduction. So in the first year probably of the podcast, it was me every single week reading out the script of the intro again and again. And the reason why I started pre-recording them and just putting that intro clip at the beginning of the podcasts, spoiler alert, that's what I do. I get ridiculed for this in the podcast community, but hey, the reason why I do this is a very intentional reason, and it's because the part that I mess up on every time without fail is the beginning of the podcast, especially with the DFW episodes, because I have to read out the script new every week. So I figured if I got rid of that hindrance or that hurdle at the beginning, it would help me want to record more. It would help me get through some of my awkwardness and things, which it totally did. Changing the intro was one of the best decisions I made for sure. So despite all the ridicule, it was something that I ended up cherishing as a decision later. But I might experiment with this kind of music playing through the intro because I think it was really well done, especially considering the expectations that I came into all of this with. I think, again, I did a pretty good job. So I wanted to ask you first about your initial thoughts on the book and why this was your favorite.
I really like this novel because it's in the first person, limited point of view. So we really get to see through the eyes of Jack his shock and horror of a postmodern world and apply it to ourselves and the world we live in now. I remember I was about halfway through the novel, reading it in a locked car in the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport parking garage, when I realized how it's just so realistic.
So like when compared to books like Frankenstein or Madame Bovary, this touched you more as an individual? Yeah, we're getting to some parts that are a little bit sketchily edited through. I definitely, this is what more along the lines of what I was remembering before. And what's interesting is I was not using a professional microphone like I do now. You can surely tell when you're listening to this episode when I'm speaking in 2020 and when I'm speaking in 2018. And that's partially because when you use built-in MacBook Pro audio, it's harder to regulate your voice and keep the background consistent. So there's a lot of times, especially in the intro of the episode, where I was noticing almost different acoustics every time I was speaking or like splicing in another clip. I was sitting in the exact same position. Probably I was getting a little louder each time, or maybe a little more annoyed or something each time I tried to re-record that kind of clip. But yeah, I definitely can tell that there's a lot of weird audio issues that are just, they don't match up. And this will be definitely a theme that we run into in the rest of the interview. But again, it was my first time editing, and this is more along the lines, again, like I said, of what I expected for this experience of looking back at everything.
Yeah, and it has a different tone than most other books because there's subtle comedy throughout the whole novel, but it's more of a satire and critiquing society and technology.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask you about any other postmodern books that you've read, because I'm obsessed with postmodernism, like Vonnegut, and I kind of never realized that you also liked postmodern.
I like postmodern, like Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. Mm-hmm. Who did Catch-22?
Joseph Heller.
And Vonnegut's Hocus Pocus. But I think this is like a different flavor of modernism.
Yeah, I agree. This book is one of the poster children of postmodernism. Yeah, especially since it's been researched and discussed so thoroughly.
Yeah. I like it maybe because it's a modern book and it's not a war book, so it's not trying to critique like the 50s war ideals and stuff, but more of the modern and future aspects of society.
But at the same time, it also has some of those war themes in it, like
absolutely,
the second part.
Yeah, I will say, when I first started getting into literature, I read a lot of postmodernism, and I think that has influenced how I read today as well. Literally, I read all of Kurt Vonnegut's books. I, like, couldn't get my hands on enough of them. It was sort of like Goosebumps when I was a kid. I just went through a lot of the Goosebumps, especially the Horrorland novels. Just love that experience. And postmodernism was no exception. I started getting into it more and more, and nowadays, of course, with Infinite Jest, that knowledge comes in handy for sure. Just so you all are aware, I will be skipping through the podcast a little bit just to make sure that I'm only listening to the parts that may be pertinent, parts that I have actual commentary on. So I'll be skipping through a little bit at this point, and also especially near the end of the podcast as we start talking about super nitty-gritty specifics of the novel, we don't necessarily need to go through all of that.
Oh, also Waves and Radiation. I thought this was really interesting, but I was talking to someone about this, and Jack has no character goal or motivation, and this is so different from all of the other books before Don DeLillo, because usually when you read a book, the character has a goal, or they have like some motivation or some need that they need to fulfill in the totality of the novel, but Jack is literally just living his life and telling us what his life is about. He has no desires whatsoever. But at the same time, even though there is no motivation and this book isn't necessarily intrinsically driven from the outset, it's so, so captivating. I kind of tip my hat to Don DeLillo's prose just because it's so riveting.
One thing that I'm noticing for sure as we get into this interview a little bit more is I remembering how much I was into minimalism and intentionalism at this point in my life. And this was the first year that I really settled into my new goals in life as a minimalist, as an intentionalist, really deciding to curate what I was saying. And I can definitely remember my joy and my happiness at finding these little gems of lines within the podcast and thinking like, yeah, I hope someone picks up on that. I hope someone really finds value in that. And there's this wonderful mantra that I've heard on the Minimalist podcast before. One of their guests has said it, I think. And the mantra is that they only speak when their words are more valuable or more important than silence. And this is something that I definitely hear emulated to whatever extent in this first podcast, and indeed something that I think about in everything that I create, whether it's a blog post or a podcast or what have you. And I really appreciate how there is this continuity between the 130th or whatever number this episode is and the very first episode. I think that's really splendid and really cool.
Yeah, we get our first glimpse into the society there too, how Jack at his university, they wear those giant cloaks as a symbol of status.
I love those, yeah.
And so the author's trying to poke something there. We also get some hints of society, how they react to things when they see that a school had a disaster of some type. I forgot, wasn't it like a chemical spill?
Oh, yeah.
Or something.
Chemical spill, yeah.
And it doesn't even scare them. It's so regular by then.
Yeah.
And they're just so numbed that they just, like, don't even acknowledge it.
It almost makes me think of the school shootings and stuff like that. Yeah, there's this great documentary called Tower, and it's about the University of Texas shooting. University of Texas at Houston, I think. And it was the late 60s. And it was just so incredibly alarming. That event really stuck in history. It's kind of like Columbine. Like, everyone knows what that is, and everyone knows what is it called?
Kent State.
Kent State, yeah. It seems like the society is so over it. They don't even remember those choice few spills or shootings or events anymore, which is so alarming, especially for us.
I do want to mention a couple things about my guest at this point. His name is Lucien. I wish that I had taken more time to allow him to say more and to introduce himself more properly to all of you. And I definitely am going to try to incorporate that into future interviews. I'm learning a lot from this episode, especially since it's a very rare opportunity for me to get an interview nowadays. I've sort of interviewed all my friends and I've done all of that route, and I've interviewed some really intelligent, amazing people, and I hope to continue doing that, hint hint. But Yeah, Lucienne is one of my closest friends from high school. We were pretty much inseparable in high school. He's just such a kind individual, and it means a lot to me even today that he would volunteer basically to be in my first episode. I know that this was not easy for either of us. He's very introverted, or at least he was in high school, and I had a lot of anxiety about it. So, again, it just means a lot that he was there even during the first episode.
Okay, so the second part, the airborne toxic event.
I appreciated that section for the environmental and physiological aspects that this society creates for themselves and how they kind of paint themselves into a corner with their own technology and development, and it plays upon their own ignorance. That whole section is really nebulous, and it doesn't even have like separate chapters. It's just one long section. And we see how the characters that were set up in the first chapter or the first section respond to this event and how they look to others to see what the appropriate response is and just how quickly a uniform society can crumble.
You guys have no idea how much I feel like Graham Stephan right now. I think Graham Stephan's my favorite YouTuber at this point. He's so funny, but what he calls this an infinite monetization loop where you just react to a video and you have other people react on your channel to the video, and then everyone just reacts to those reaction videos. I feel like this is sort of like the start of an infinite monetization loop. Of course, there's no ads on my channel, and we have Patreon for that. Thank you, patrons. But yeah, it's really funny. I really feel like Graham Stephan because he does a lot of these review videos. I'm gonna link him in the description so you can check him out. In terms of actual white noise here, I literally have not read that book since maybe junior or senior year of high school. So it's been at least 4 years, maybe 3 or 4 years since then. And I do agree though, I remember vaguely what it was about, and I can tell from what we're saying that DeLillo is reflecting on our society and he's very cognizant of the problems that we have. And it's interesting to me, especially since we're in the last 100 pages of Infinite Jest by now, how spot on DFW was with his loo or his tipping of the hat to postmodernism. And it doesn't matter what you call it, postmodernism or just a tribute to postmodernism. I find that a lot of what I read now and a lot of what is in literature now, especially I think of dystopia almost and this new female-focused dystopia, like on Blue Ticket, which we did recently, all of that is really influenced by this first taste of the magic, really, that DeLillo was writing on the page. And how much DeLillo was able to say to society, hey, look, I have a mirror in my hand. Would you like to take a look in it? And it blows my mind that postmodernism is something that I was lucky enough to get into in high school. I've read Kurt Vonnegut's, literally his entire life works, all of them, like even the really hard to find stuff. I've read all of it. I couldn't get enough of it. And I think that at this time, as I mentioned, I had a big disillusionment about society, and that manifested in minimalism and intentionalism. And I think part of that disillusionment was really because I was listening to these great thinkers and looking in the mirror and saying, I want no part of that.
I was actually wondering about the one long part thing. Do you think that was a deliberate move on DeLillo's end, or?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why do you think so?
Maybe it just adds to the chaos and seemingly unstructured idea of that section.
I'm going to skip ahead here a bit again just because we start talking about some pretty nitty-gritty specifics of the book. Of course, this episode is linked down below, or at least in the show notes at relevanceofliterature.com/notes for reference for you guys in case you want to look back or you're curious or you want to listen to this episode unabridged, but for the sake of the review, I'm just going to skip through some of those parts because I honestly don't remember the specifics of the book well enough to comment super in depth on what we are actually saying about the book.
And it almost reminds me, Malcolm Gladwell has this great podcast called Revisionist History, and you should check it out if you have the chance. But one of the episodes recently was about a mass hysteria event in Belgium, I think.
You guys, I was literally so obsessed with Revisionist History. I'm listening to the fifth season now, but my obsession isn't as strong, I admit, as when I was 16, 17, 18. I quoted Revisionist History in almost every conversation, and listening back to this does make me smile a little bit because I had just listened to that episode about this Belgian event, like, the night before, the day before, and I was just itching to bring it up somewhere, and I remember being so proud that I actually brought up something and, like, regurgitated this information so fast. But yeah, Revisionist History, I still recommend it. I think it gets you thinking. It's a really valuable body of work. And I am such a big fan of Malcolm Gladwell still. I think he has made being an intellectual cool again, which I owe him a lot for. So thank you, Mr. Gladwell. All of his stuff is linked down below.
And it was the one where they thought that Coca-Cola was poisoning the whole country. And so it was the largest recall in Coca-Cola of all time. It was in the 90s. There was literally nothing wrong with the Coke. But these whole cities at a time would get, like, intense nausea. And, you know, it was literally just in their heads. So, yeah, stuff like that. And I think we don't realize how prevalent those things are.
I also really appreciate how DeLillo...
Is it DeLillo or DeLillo? I've always pronounced it DeLillo. It's sort of like when there's a hard character name and you just pronounce it the way you hear it in your head, but you've never heard it spoken, so you're not really sure. This happens to me all the time on the show. Just all the time when I'm doing book reviews. I have no idea how to pronounce the name. I rarely look it up. I just try. Especially DFW, I would say, is a book where I just guess at most of the names. I still think it's DeLillo, and what's interesting to me is that I've been saying DeLillo in this whole podcast, yet Lucien, at like probably the 35 or 45 minute mark at this point, sticks at his guns and he says DeLillo. I sort of admire that.
Captures how society is obsessed with disasters. It seems like everything's planned and controlled, yet when something unplanned like this happens, everyone's obsessed about it. It's kind of grotesque. They're also watching the plane crash on TV. They love disasters so much that they even rehearse evacuation drills where the daughter stands in, is a dead person in their own street.
It's a little funny because I start talking about how a lot of this novel is motivated by a fear of death in this next part of the interview that I'm going to skip a little through, just again because of proportionality of this very interesting anniversary episode. And this was way before the mortality book club thing, but it's cool to me to see that. My interests haven't changed that much. I know my voice has changed. That's one thing I've been noticing through this whole thing. And it wasn't because I was nervous. It's not because... It might be a little bit because I was recording that episode in the morning, and most of the episodes I record now are in the evening. But yeah, my voice has definitely gotten deeper. My accent has changed a little bit. I think as a result of learning German, I knew no German. Like, maybe a couple words from Duolingo, but really I wasn't serious about it at this point, so yeah, big changes were about to occur in my life, and I didn't even know it.
Do you want to talk about Dialorama?
Yeah, that was probably my favorite section, just because personally I'm into drug development and research and that kind of thing. Jack is given this gift.
Like, he gives him a gun, right?
Yeah.
I forget where I was reading it from, but it said when a gun is introduced in a story, it needs to be fired. And that's absolutely true in this.
is it you get the gun really early on, and you know pretty much instinctively that it's going to be fired. And so it's just really interesting to see, like, even in postmodernism, they're kind of adhering to this age-old rule of a gun needing to be fired.
Genuinely, I just blew my own mind. That makes so much sense. I think the first and last time I thought about that was during this interview. But it's so true. When a gun is introduced, it must be fired. Just because that's, it follows from the introduction of a gun. That is so wild. That is so interesting. I'm honestly shocked.
Okay, now I think we should talk about genre. So postmodernism, I have a quote from allaboutphilosophy.org, and this is a paraphrase. So it says, postmodernism can't be defined because it is in itself a collection of inabsolutes. Personally, I ultimately think that it's just so hard to define the genre that people have stopped trying. We definitely know that this is a post-World War II category. There's this book called Postmodernism or the Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism. It's by Jameson. It's kind of like an English textbook, if you guys are into that. I haven't read it, so I can't necessarily recommend it, but apparently he has the most direct and adequate definition of postmodernism.
Okay, I'm gonna cut myself off here. I disagree with this completely nowadays. I think there's totally really succinct, good ways to define postmodernism. I have an episode on Thursdays with DFW where I talk about genre a lot, and I'm gonna reference that in the description so you guys can have a better sense of what I'm talking about and what Lucianne and I are talking about when we're going at this issue of postmodernism.
I also wanted to talk about characters that are purely there for postmodern shock value.
Lyle. Infinite Jest. Who would have known?
I don't know if this is a term that other people use, but I just find that there are characters that are inputted purely for the shock value. I wanted to talk about Tommy Roy Foster, the kid that Heinrich plays chess with, who's a convicted murderer.
Oh, yes, through the mail or something?
Yeah, through mail. And
then, oh, the snake guy.
And Oris Mercator, the snake guy.
Yeah.
Those are both characters just purely for the shock value, because Heinrich is literally a little kid playing chess with a convicted murderer in jail. They're ultimately okay with it, which is something that's so odd to me. And Oris Mercator, his whole impetus in the book is to break the world record for sitting in a cage with poisonous snakes. It's just like that whole idea is so blasphemous. The only use for him is for shock value.
Yeah, it shows like the obsession with death and fear of death, how it's such a stunt for him to do that.
Lucianne definitely took this way farther than I thought we were gonna go. And he made some really astute conclusions when it came to the postmodern shock value of characters. And I absolutely agree nowadays. I do think that, for example, Lyle in Infinite Jest, he has a lot more uses than just being there for the pure shock value, like the pure blasphemy of it all, as I said in this first episode. But at that time, I was really taken aback by the idea of an author writing in a character basically just to tell a joke. And to this day, the reason why I love Lyle so much and love characters like this Horace Mercator guy is because I had never interacted or even thought about that idea before in literature. And it was something that really excited me as a young reader and someone who is really getting into a lot of the classics, especially.
Okay, also, I wanted to talk about stuff that's unique to this book that kind of breaks from postmodernism.
One thing that I am a little critical about at this point is, how can I introduce something that breaks from postmodernism without having provided a definition of postmodernism in the first place? That seems a little sketchy to me. Seems like a continuity error in a film almost, where, like, you know, a character is facing one way and then when they flip back to that same angle, they're facing a completely different way or something, or like they've replaced an apple with a pear randomly. I don't know. That's something that just seems a little off to me. And again, I hope that since then I've remedied the fact that I really just dropped the ball on defining postmodernism here. I do think the discussion that follows about descriptions and different things that really do depart from postmodernism as we see it most of the time in White Noise, I think that part is a really cool thing that I added in this first episode. However, I am pretty critical of the fact that I did not take the time to define my terms very well.
The air was a reverie of wistful summer things, the last languorous day, a chance to go bare-limbed once more, smell the mown clover.
My first quote is by Jack, where he's pondering the existence of death. He thinks that, "Shouldn't death, I thought, be a swan dive, graceful, white-winged, and smooth, leaving the surface undisturbed?"
Okay, next. "I'd like to lose interest in myself. Is there any chance of that happening?"
Another one by Bet is when she's talking about her daily choices. "Either I'm taking something and I don't remember, or either I gain weight or I run up the stadium steps." And then Jack responds by saying, "Sounds like a boring life." And then Babette ends it by saying, "I hope it lasts forever."
Okay, and this quote, I almost got goosebumps when I read it. It's near the end. And this is a transition from, like, the TV said this to a human says this. "A woman passing on the street said, 'A decongestant, an antihistamine, a cough suppressant, a pain reliever.'" And so it's like these like really irrelevant lines, but now DeLillo gives it to a human at the end of the book, and it's so chilling.
I found this section to be really cute. I liked all the quotes. I still really think that the quotes in this book hold up, especially I like how they really, really relate back to what we were talking about in the main part of our discussion. And that was totally unintentional, by the way, but I do really like how the quotes are pretty seamless. One comment or criticism that I do, maybe a piece of feedback that I do have for this part of the podcast, as with the podcast as a whole, pretty much, is that our pacing, or rather the pacing of that I edited into this interview, is pretty quick, and I wish that I had taken the time and appreciated breathing, appreciated silence a little more, because again, I think that would have added a lot to the weight of what we were saying, because we get a lot of really great ideas out there, but it doesn't just have to be a string of speech. Like, I don't edit out pauses as much as I used to, for example, because that's the cadence of my speech. That's how I'm speaking, and I feel that it's pretty unnatural at a certain point to really doctor someone's actual cadence of their speech, which is what I used to do.
Do you want to talk about the title?
Yeah.
When I first started reading this, I thought of white noise, like, background
like
sounds. Yeah, to, like, drown out other noises and stuff. And then during the first section, I thought white noise, like, technology, how it's always around us and buzzing and filling our minds.
Could you hear how shocked I was? I was literally blown away that he asked this question. It wasn't even a question that I had thought about, and it was just the perfect question to end the interview off on. And I just really, yeah, I really appreciate that moment looking back, because the questions that I had prepared and the layout that I had prepared were good and they were well thought through. But this wild card, I think, really put the cherry on the cake, or the cherry on the milkshake or whatever. And again, I just, yeah, I really, really appreciate this question looking back.
Okay, let's talk about relevance. I think we've been touching on it the whole conversation and kind of trying to save it for this. We talked about consumerism already. I think that's pretty fleshed out. Historical significance. It's literally called College on the Hill, okay? America was founded on the City on the Hill principle. It goes all the way back to the colonies. If you took history classes in school, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. But it's even referenced today. It's just so cool to see and how that term was totally flipped on its head and used in this way in the book. The age-old morals and questions and fears that this book really plays on, especially things like death and like aging and relationships, all those things. And I think ultimately all of those symbols and concepts that we've kind of talked about today can be used as devices to get those harder conversations going.
I do like the historical connection that I made there. I do remember that I loved history in high school as well. I was pretty much a full liberal arts devotee by that point without even knowing it, which is fun again to look back on and see.
Finally, related reading, rapid fire. You mentioned Catch-22 by Joseph Heller. God Bless You, Dr. Kevorkian by Kurt Vonnegut. It is great. The Pity of It All by Amos Ellen. It's super interesting, especially since Jack is the professor of Hitler studies, and so if you want to know a little bit more about those tensions and those developments early on, that's a great book to check out. Why I Live at the P.O. by Eudora Welty. The prose just reminds me so much, and I don't know why. I wish I could articulate it better, but it's a short story. It's available online, so just check it out and read it if you have a chance. Hocus Pocus by Kurt Vonnegut. You mentioned this one too. The main character is super similar to Jack. I love that book. It's one of my favorite Kurt Vonnegut books.
Again, I don't really understand why I had to go rapid fire on that. I know the interview took a really long time, about what we were thinking, like an hour and a half or something, which is very typical. Usually my interviews nowadays run longer than that. But yeah, it just added a quickness to the already quick pacing that I do think now is unnecessary. I love this segment, though, I must say, this related reading segment. I didn't do this for too many episodes. It just sort of dropped off naturally, but I think it would be pretty valuable, especially on some of the other episodes that we're doing in this new fiction, true shelf kind of series. To just tie these books in to the books before them, books that I've read, or pieces, maybe even pieces of art or pieces of music that I find connected somehow. I think comparative literature is a really valuable conversation to be having and subject to really care about in general, so let me know what you guys think about that in the comments. Should we reintroduce this related reading kind of section? I know that we do that in the comments every once in a while, especially with Infinite Jest, but I'd love to broaden the conversation with that a little more. I think that's a really good idea that we've just missed out on, or maybe not integrated in the best way yet on the show.
Cool. Well, do you have any last comments about the book?
We have like a reliance on privacy, yet this technology dependence kind of is contrary to that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, stay tuned for the next episode in 2 weeks' time. We'll have another special guest, and we'll be chatting about Mother Night by Kurt Vonnegut. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Acast, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find community. In other words, it helps a ton.
So I found this to be a really enjoyable, really fruitful exercise. I think there are a lot of things that I've reminded myself of during the course of this review. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And again, this episode, and really every episode, is for you guys. I'm trying to make content that you guys find valuable and that you share with people and that gets you thinking. On Patreon, it says, Didion Hawthorne and the In-Between is creating discourse. It used to be like podcasts and blog posts, and I just realized, no, that's not my goal here. My goal is to create discourse. So thank you for doing that with me on this platform. Again, it's such a great honor. I have thoroughly appreciated the last 2 years on the show. I look forward to the next two. And I will see you on Thursday for another momentous occasion, our last section of Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace.
If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes.
We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.